Attention Austin musicians and music industry professionals. Are you having a difficult time navigating these tricky waters? Well, the Austin Music Foundation is here to help you. The Austin Music Foundation is a nonprofit dedicated to strengthening and connecting the local music community with innovative programs that empower musicians, music industry professionals, and music businesses within Austin's creative economy. With expert panels, consultations, mentoring, and mixers, AMF's programs provide the necessary tools and opportunities to help the Austin music industry succeed. Now look, ever since COVID took over last year, everything's moved online. The consultations are online. They're at no cost to the artist or to the music industry professional. Just go to austinmusicfoundation.org. That's austinmusicfoundation.org to find out how they can help you. Austin Music Foundation is here to help. Let's get down. Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys are all easing into your new year in style and grace and in health, for God's sake. We got this crazy, man, this is the virus that never quit, baby. Imagine a couple years ago, we're sitting here talking. I'm like, yeah, I'll just probably be doing these things on Zoom for a couple weeks and we'll go back to normal. That was in 2020. It's 2022, man. Things are nuts. Things are nuts. And listen, gang, I realized, like, shit, you know, I'm going to Vegas this weekend with Skyrocket. I'm playing this big debutante ball thing on Saturday. And we got a big show at Antone's next Friday. So, like, hey, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And this is, you know, we got to make some money, man. So I got to stay healthy. So I went out on, I looked up on Monday morning, any place that was available to give me a boost. I got a boost, got boosted on Monday afternoon around 2. Around 5, I started feeling, you know, weird, like kind of out of it. But like, you know, it's a good time. Kind of like, you know what I mean? Like high or drunk or kind of trippy. Just like, all right, man, it's cool, man. I feel cool. And I was feeling cool. Woke up Tuesday morning. It was like the end of the world, dude. I had chills. My joints all ache, like my knees, my elbows, my shoulders, my fingers. And was just super out of it all day. Tried to take Rosie to the park. The dog park. I just didn't make it there very long. I had to come back and ended up sleeping really. I mean, I don't even know how much, a lot. Woke up a couple times. I had to change out of the clothes I was sleeping in because I was both shivering and freezing with chills, but also just completely drenched in sweat. So I woke up Wednesday morning back to normal. But man, that booster kicked my ass. And I'm glad I took it on a day when I didn't have much to do. You know, oh, there was some stuff coming out though this week. The Austin Music Foundation's artist development program, our singles from the record that I told you guys that we were making back in November, they're starting to drop and they're going to be available on Bandcamp in the next couple of weeks. I'll let you know when they are, but, you can go check out KUTX.org and look up Song of the Day. And, Pleasure Venom had a song on there. Quentin Arispe had a song on there, or Quentin and the Past Lives had a song on there, and Natalie Price all this week. Next week, we're going to have even more. That's right. That's right. Anastasia Hara is going to, they're going to play an Anastasia Hara song. They're going to play a TV Temple song. It's going to be great. It's going to be a good time. KUTX.org. All right. To get involved. So yeah, so those singles are all kind of like getting debuted on radio this week and next week. So that's very exciting. All the work that we did for the last few months coming to fruition and out there for people to hear, and also judgment, man. Do you like this stuff? Check it out. We worked with Frenchie Smith, A&R Peterson, kind of co-producing at the helm. I was in the background doing whatever it is I was doing, playing on some stuff, some Natalie Price stuff, or hanging out, being weird, trying to make people laugh, trying to keep Rosie from running out the gate. Anyway, check it out, KUTX.org. And if you want to find out more about the Austin Music Foundation, go to austinmusicfoundation.org as well. Gang, also on Tuesday, I was totally out of it and started like kind of like looking at my phone, and people would text me and go like, shit, man, I can't believe it about Dale. And I'm like, oh my God, what are you talking about? Dale Dudley. I looked it up, and he had gotten let go from his job, or his contract wasn't renewed, is what the people over there at the MS Media Corporation, whatever it's called now, had to say. And basically, they kept the rest of the guys from the morning show and didn't renew Dale's contract. To me, that's getting fired. So I was sad to see my dear friend go. If you listen to the show, you know that he's been an important part of the show. He was an inspiration for the show. When I first started listening to podcasts and thinking about, like, man, I wonder what I would do for a podcast. Dale put out like one episode of him just in his house by himself before they did the Taint and Teabag podcast. This was like in 2011, like, you know, over 10 years ago. And I remember being in my apartment and cleaning my apartment and listening to this podcast. And it was riveting. I can't remember how long it was now. To me, it was either, you know, 30 minutes or 4 hours. I can't remember. But it was a good amount of time. It got very heavy. Dale just opened up and was just by himself drinking and talking. And it was intense. Inspiration for the show. Longtime friend of mine. I've been going on the Dale and Dudley and Bob show since 1993. And Dale and I have struck up a friendship. I'm friends with his wife, Amanda. Skyrocket played their wedding. I played the 30th anniversary at the Paramount. I was in the house band and sang a song. So, you know, it's been a long, long time we've been friends. And his friendship to me has been very important. I've always been able to go on the show. You know, he's invited me on many times, but also I've asked to go on, and he's always been open to it. My friend Scrappy Judd Newcomb and I in 2019 and 2020 made a bunch of music for them for their radio show, original music for their topics that they would go into, funny songs that we recorded and did for them. Anyway, it's been a long time friendship. So finding out that he was let go was very sad, because he's been a pillar in this community and in the entertainment industry, and a friend to so many musicians. I mean, I'm not his only friend. There's a bunch of people he's friends with out there. Everyone is Skyrocket individually, and the people, you know, guys like Vallejo, guys like Bob Schneider, all kinds of people. He's got a lot of friends out there, and he's a great guy. Okay. So he lost his job and I was sad, but, what was I going to even say about it? But you know, things go on. That's what I was going to say. Nobody really is a morning guy on a radio show for almost 35 years. Now, that's almost unheard of. So that record's been broken. And if someone at the radio station wants to go a different way, you can't really blame them. They've been doing this a long time. And at some point, they're like, you know, shit, let's change it up. Doesn't change the fact that it's sad for Dale. Doesn't mean that now he's like, oh, shit, what do I do? But you know what? He's going to do great. He's a smart guy. He's been doing this for a long time. But I appreciate everything he's done for me personally. Oh, there was one other thing I was going to say. I remember when I started the podcast, he gave me advice about making sure that my personality was strong enough that people came to listen to the show for me and not just for the guests that I had on, which was great advice. And then one day he said to me, when I put out like five or six of them, he goes, "You want me to come on and double your audience?" And I laughed and I was like, of course, that would be great. So he came on and he literally doubled my audience. So early on, I owe a lot to Dale Dudley, and I appreciate him, and I appreciate his wife, Amanda. They've been great friends and very supportive of everything I've done this whole time. So that's what I'm trying to say. Thank you, Dale. Thank you for being in radio for so long. Good luck with all of your next endeavors, and I love you. All right? Gang, have I talked to you about the refreshing goodness of Guayaquil Organic Yerba Mate? Oh, it is fantastic. They have a plethora of flavors. Very many. I actually met this guy, Craig, and he was nice enough to slide me five cases over here, all the different flavors. Absolutely fantastic flavors. Today, I will be cracking open Guayaquil Organic Yerba Mate Enlightenment. Now, this is not a sparkling drink. Some of them are sparkling. Some of them aren't. So I'm shaking it up a little bit. It's a 16-ounce can, and it only has 120 calories. Now, all these flavors are great. Let me crack this open here. Oh, yeah. Now we're talking. We're talking about Guayaquil Organic Yerba Mate Enlightenment. Mm. Oh, this is delicious. A couple months ago, I was at the Bubble working on a recording, and they had a whole lot of Guayaquil Organic Yerba Mate in the fridge. You know, like, hey, man, take it. They had all the different flavors, so I started trying them. I'm like, man, this is delicious. So I ended up touching base through my friend Scott Collins. He hooked me up with the gang over there at Guayaquil. I met Craig. Craig was like, all right, yeah, man, we'd love to support the podcast. They brought me five cases. I love to support this great, great company. You know this case. It's in the yellow can. You can find it wherever the energy drinks are, at like 7-Eleven or your convenience store, wherever you get your energy drinks. Absolutely fantastic. It gives you energy, right? But it doesn't like get you all, you know, jacked up to the point where you're shaking and sweating and then you crash really hard. This gives you a nice, mellow energy, something you can deal with, something to get you through the day without the crash. Guayaki Organic Yerba Mate, this enlightenment is absolutely delicious. They have all kinds of flavors. Check them out. Gang, I have a great show for you today. Zach and Danny Green, the couple that fronts Nashville born and bred alt-country five-piece Bird Talker, are my guests on the show. Now, Bird Talker just released their second LP in October. It's self-titled. It's called Bird Talker. But they have had an incredible incredible career since they started playing in 2017. And they released their first album, One, in 2018. They have a single, Heavy, that has over 80 million streams on Spotify alone. Crazy. They've debuted at the Grand Ole Opry and also returned there and played again just this past December. These are really amazing feats, right? They just played in Austin here at Antone's in November. And anyway, you know, for a band that had done so well between 2017 and 2019, I was really fascinated to see, like, wow, what happened in 2020? Well, in 2020, they hunkered down and they wrote this amazingly beautiful record. The self-titled LP, Bird Talker, just came out in October. Fantastic record. Great songs on there. I'll play the song Better Days on there. So I guess without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Zach and Danny Green from Nashville alt-country five-piece, Bird Talker. Let's get down.
To find what's broken down, is there truth among the wreckage that I forgot along the way? I know that I can't stay.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically what I was saying is that here your band that lives in Nashville, you played the Grand Ole Opry twice, but then I noticed not just your sound in general isn't like traditional country or what one would expect at the Grand Ole Opry stage, but there's a song called Taking Control specifically that to me sounded more rooted in Devo than Bob Wills. See how I changed the reference?
Yeah,
oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and thank you for those references.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's certainly not a Patsy Cline song, like you said.
No, but they've been broadening or broadening their palette of genres that go in there.
Yes, that's something we've noticed here in seeing the acts that they brought on stage. They've been expanding who they're asking and bringing in, which has been fun to observe and to be a part of. Man, it's been great.
Well, your record is fantastic. Your self-titled LP.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really, really good, man. This is, do you guys write together? Is that what happens here? How do you guys make this music?
Yeah,
it fluctuates. This project, I sort of hold up in our second bedroom for several weeks and really wanted to reconnect with the stuff that I like now. Like, what do I like now? What sounds do I like now? What tempos do I like now? And I just sort of in a flurry made a bunch of demos and presented them to Danny and to the band. And she wrote a majority of the lyrics on this record. I wrote a couple songs, but it was a little bit different in years past where we would collaborate a lot more on the structures and the melodic arrangements. So this one musically has a heavy hand of mine on it, but content wise, I feel like you dug into yourself quite a bit. Yeah. So we wrote it together, but not in a typical way, I guess, that you think about writing a song with someone.
Did you write these songs during the quarantine times, the 2020? I don't know what to call it, 'cause the pandemic's still going on, but there's
right.
Yeah.
Most of them. There's a couple stragglers that were older songs that we carried forward onto this project. But yeah, the bulk of them we wrote last year in 2020.
Is that where songs like Better Days and The Dream and stuff like that kind of come from?
Yeah. Yep. Those two are from last year.
For sure. Yeah.
What was your, what was your general sort of like, were you trying to write music to reflect what you were going through or to push hope out into the world? Because I noticed there's a couple different styles of 2020 songs.
Yeah.
Like documentary songs, and then they're like songs of like a better day is coming kind of thing.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's funny. Like, I think Better Days really has that. It's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of digging into the feeling, and then also, you know, trying to have an optimistic take on it. I think that comes down to like a personality difference between Zach and I. Like, I certainly at the time was feeling a lot and really just wanting to write songs about the feelings. And then Zach has this way of always wanting to kind of lift the situation and shine a little light on it. And that's something that I sometimes find really frustrating, but most of the time it's something that I really need in order to balance me out. So, right. Yeah, there's a little bit of both, but I know I tend to lean into just like, be honest about the feeling, you know?
Yeah. And I would say, I guess your question was, is it for the people or is it from our brains and our feelings? I guess was sort of the duality question you asked. And I would say most, the answer to that is the songs that I've written, and I don't need to speak for you, I guess, but I really try to avoid writing for people. That starts to feel kind of slimy to me in a way that maybe is a little bit silly, but
you mean like writing for another artist?
No, writing for our listeners.
Right.
Writing for an audience. Sure. That starts to feel really manipulative and strange. And I've been in that headspace when I've been trying to get in touch with creativity, and it more often than not just falls so flat. And yeah. It's so uninspiring. So I'd say that song specifically, Better Days, like Danny said, is the balance between our of two tendencies we have. One is for me to be sort of belligerently optimistic and hello, my friend. Who's that?
That's Rosie.
Hey, Rosie.
Rosie's decided there's an enemy outside.
Well, thank you, Rosie, for warning us. But yeah, for me to be the optimist and for Danny to sort of dig in and engage the more unpleasant feelings, I guess, is how I've learned to quantify them, even though they're important, you know, they're just as important.
Right.
So yeah, that I'd say that's the answer to that.
Yeah, but when I was going through like the history of your band, you hit this amazing stride with this song Heavy that kind of like connected. And then you were really moving and grooving. And when everything shut down, was that just like a kick in the stomach? Because it's so hard to get to a point for anyone. And you guys, you know this. We all know this. It's so hard to have that happen with one of your songs. Like, I don't even know how to describe how hard it is to get like 80 million streams. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was chance, man.
Yeah. But then to have all of the momentum just totally stop because you were touring and stuff, right? Behind it and playing festivals and fucking.
Yeah, we were doing all that stuff. Yeah. Strangely enough, we had we'd received an offer for essentially a hedge fund to purchase our back catalog. And it was a number that was attractive enough to really consider it, and we ended up going through with it. And so we had actually planned that happened in 2019. So we had planned for 2020 for us to kind of hole up and write a new record. So when the old sickness came, it was already aligned for us to do exactly what we had planned. We did not plan a tour for that year. we didn't really plan anything except for creating a record, recording it, getting it mastered, finding other missing parts of our team. We had just transitioned through to no management, and we're looking for a manager. And so, yeah, a lot of clerical stuff happened in 2020 for us, which we feel a lot of gratitude for in hindsight.
It was a good time to get that stuff done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a restructuring year, it felt like. So in that way, I think the space was actually kind of welcome and beneficial. You know, it kind of gave us some time to figure out what kind of record we wanted to make next and get our team together and kind of gather ourselves before the next, you know, phase of Bird Talker. So
yeah,
it was good timing.
Can I, does this hedge fund that bought your back catalog, is it, do they act as a publisher or?
Essentially, they just collect our royalties for a period of time. I think it's 20 years is the contract for us. So they bought the, I think they did buy our publishing too. I guess in a sense they work as a publisher because they're trying to exploit it in the sync world and that sort of thing. And we, you know, we'll see a small wink of that if they do land something, but there's no real interaction with, besides the transaction that took place, there hasn't been really any interaction with that company that purchased our catalog.
Okay.
So I've never actually had a publishing deal either. So I can't really speak to that and out of experience, but yeah, it's been pretty hands off.
Yeah.
Overall, but a lot of gratitude that it afforded us the ability to take some time and pay ourselves our way through 2020 when we didn't have any other income.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Do you guys have kids or anything?
They have four legs and hair all over their body. But we've got a dog, a cat, and we started this year with 9 chickens, I think, and we're down to 5. So it's been a hard year.
Yeah, one was a rooster, so we had to get rid of it. We can't have it in our county because of the cock-a-doodle doos.
Oh, really? They got canceled.
Yeah, one had. Yeah, got canceled.
Yeah.
One ran away. One got its throat slit by a raccoon.
Raccoons wield knives out there?
It seemed like it.
Maybe. They could with their tiny little hands.
With their tiny, fully dexterous hands, yeah.
So can I ask you guys... I'm sorry, just get back on this stuff because I have some questions about this because... You said you'd never had a publishing deal, but didn't like when Heavy started doing what it did. I'm sure word got around Nashville and there was a buzz about Bird Talker. And did,
sure.
did you get some meetings?
Yeah, we did take some meetings and, I guess our manager at the time didn't think that it was necessary for us to, based on the way that we made our music, which we didn't do a lot of co-writes at all. It was mostly all in-house and all of the revenue was still coming to us from these streams. Nobody really facilitated that for us except for, you know, our manager helped us find a distribution friend who worked well with him. So we just, there was a maintenance aspect to it that wanted to be propelled by both our manager and us because everything seemed to be working. And the addition of a publisher didn't appeal to the team, I guess, at the time, giving up that percentage of our income. But we did take a few meetings and they were lovely people. And I think they genuinely wanted to help, but it just didn't seem necessary after some more conversations with the rest of the team members at the time.
So there's like, you guys appreciate your autocracy.
So far, yes. This is the first year where we were for this project. We did partner with a label, Anti-Fragile, out of New York. And you know, it's a modest deal. It's certainly not a major thing or a 360 thing. It's just a one project deal, essentially a marketing budget that they're handing us and it has to be recouped. So, we're starting.
Sorry, but they took the record, the finished record is what they got. They didn't get involved before the record was finished, right?
No, after the record was finished.
So you had total autonomy on that too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
No real creative input on any of it outside of the bandmates. Yeah.
Which
feels amazing. And I really would like to keep that thread going, man. That's a really, really beautiful feeling to have that freedom. And the word respect comes to mind from the people we're working with who just validate the process and right. So keep elevating it and supporting.
There is that sort of thing where like some artists do need some sort of development, but it seems like that thing has kind of gone away. But how did you guys sort of like cut your teeth? Like when did you guys meet and when did you start playing together and stuff?
So we got married in 2012 and neither of us really had any ambition to be in a band. I had casually written music as like a creative outlet for myself for a few years with some buddies for fun. We never played a show, just like in the garage. And I was working on a song and I asked Dani for help and she helped a lot. She like wrote the rest of it essentially. And it was beautiful. And we kept doing that. And all of the people in the band right now are friends that we met through sharing it, you know, discreetly with friends saying like, what do you think about this? Is this something we should do? Much more insecure people back then, I think. And, we started playing shows in Nashville in some small clubs, probably played 20 shows, maybe 15, 20 shows in town.
Yeah. It was strange. Cause that like cutting the teeth phase was, everything happened really quickly. Like Heavy was on the very first EP we ever put out. So we, you know, put out our first five songs and we're just kind of playing around Nashville. And then Heavy got the playlisting that it did. And then all of a sudden we were able, you know, people were listening to the song all over the country and we were afforded the ability to go tour the record. And so, those early days, I still feel like Heavy kind of was this accelerant on the whole process to where, you know, I feel like we were cutting our teeth kind of out on the road still, you know, taking it out on tour and the whole process kind of felt like a learning curve the whole way, you know?
That probably happened over the course of 24 months. I'd say our first tour, we released it in 2016 Heavy. And then we toured in 2017.
Yeah. With the St. John's. Wait, yeah, I think maybe we're off a year. Maybe.
I can't remember.
Did you get your asses kicked when you first were out there playing shows? Like,
yes, I would say so. Monitors were a whole thing for us to learn about, you know, singing over the top.
Yeah.
Just figuring out how to get it mixed well so we could hear ourselves and each other. That was so difficult for us.
Yeah, playing live was just...
I think we sounded like borderline shitty for a while.
Yeah.
I would say.
Probably.
But, you know, we continued on. We continued on and did the next... We kept honing it in, you know. We kept honing it in and being bad and accepting it and then learning about what we could do better. And this year for the first, we bought ourselves and built ourselves. Well, our guitar player built it. We bought ourselves an in-ear rig. And so that has changed everything for us. Danny's got kind of a quieter voice and I have a very loud, boisterous voice. And so on stage, that was a really hard dynamic to balance.
Yeah.
Relating to performance.
Sure.
And so having in-ears is just, it's a miracle. Our story was quick. We released Heavy. Started touring shortly after. Really feel like we have our wits for the first time after this tour. Like we're a pretty well-oiled machine, it feels like now. And that's like a unique feeling in the story of Bird Talker so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was our third tour, man. Just our third one.
Do you feel like like when you're walking on stage, you have a little bit more of a confident feeling at this point?
I would say so.
Yeah.
I mean, just the variable of, you know, meeting a stranger as the sound guy and trying to figure out what your mix is going to sound like that night, that whole dynamic is gone. Now we show up and we have a preset for our ears and everything sounds the same night.
What about front of house?
From night to night.
You have a front of house?
We don't have a front of house. We can't afford that quite yet. Don't have a lighting guy. or gal. So, you know, piece by piece, I think that honing in the live show and making it sound as best as possible was primary for us. And the next step hopefully is like a TM front of house guy once we get our streaming revenue back up.
Yeah. You guys played here in Austin at Antone's. Was it?
We did.
It was your tour, or were you opening for someone?
It was our tour.
That was ours this year. That was our first time at Antone's too. And it's fucking great. We loved it there.
It's great.
Yeah, we played Stubbs before that. We played the small room in Stubbs a couple times, which is also a really fun room to play.
Yeah,
Stubbs is great too.
It smells like barbecue, but it is a fun room to play.
Yeah,
it smells like and tastes like barbecue.
It does
for sure.
Smell like barbecue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I always, that's always one of my things. Like when I leave there and I get in the car, I'm like, oh yeah, me and all my stuff smells like barbecue.
Oh, it smells like me.
Smell like cedar chips.
Dude, the house guy there, this guy, Danny, that guy's been there since 1999.
Are you at Antone's or at Stubbs?
No, at Stubbs.
Danny.
This blonde dude.
His face is gone from my brain.
I'm drawing a blank on the Antone's house guy, but he's really nice. The glasses guy.
Yeah,
he was cheeky. He was fun.
Yeah,
he was silly, but very talented. Mm-hmm. He's a young guy. He's probably in his 30s, it seemed like. And then, what was the dog's name? And then
that I remember. That was dog? Fergus.
Fergus. There's a house dog there named Fergus.
Oh, really?
Who's this?
Dog.
Yeah, and who's the manager? Dylan. Dylan.
Oh yeah.
Dylan over there. He's fun.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He's got a cool voice. He's kind of talks like this.
Yeah, Fergus was a highlight of the Antone's experience for sure.
I love that place. Hey, who produced your first record? One.
It was co-produced with the engineer. And the engineer's name is Dylan Aldridge. And
you guys?
What's his studio's called?
And us, yeah. Skinny Elephant.
Skinny Elephant, that's right.
Yeah, that's pretty much how we've done all three of those records is, self-produced. We co-produced with the engineer. And
same as the new one?
On the EP. Yeah, same thing on this new one. We co-produced it with our buddy JD Tyner engineered it, and he actually did the same for the EP. We recorded the EP with him. So that was kind of cute to go back to the beginning and do it all over again with him in this new way.
We've never worked with a producer per se, like somebody besides the engineer being in the room with us as the band.
Yeah, it's always been through like relationships, and we kind of just collaborate with whoever we're working with.
That's cool. That's a fun way to work. Like the creative think tank, you know,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to under the someone's rule, unless that person's I'm super fun.
If that person's a good hang, I'm super open to that idea of having somebody steer the ship and me sort of fall in line to a vision of somebody that whose work I love.
Yeah.
Working as a co-producing a record is, it just means, I guess you do the same thing with a producer too. We just, everybody was generative with their ideas and their structures and arrangements and all these things. So we'd try a lot. And I think that we had a pretty good dynamic of landing on the thing that sounded best, not just because somebody's voice was loudest, mm-hmm. which that's also a skill set that we've honed in a little bit more. It's just an openness to idea and exploration, but landing somewhere where we all feel some resonance and alignment.
Right.
Yeah. I think we've gotten better at that, and that creative collaboration's felt more and more satisfying every time we do it.
Yeah.
So that makes me want to keep doing it that way, you know? So yeah, it's kind of our MO for now.
So you just finished this tour. What happens in 2022?
Good question.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
We don't know. We want to, there were a couple holes in the tour routing. Like we didn't hit the Midwest or the Southeast. So we're going to tour a little bit more and make sure we hit the rest of the country, maybe go up to Montreal and Toronto. And hopefully play some festivals over the summer. If we can grab an opening slot on another tour, we would take that, but probably less touring next year and getting back into the studio to make whatever the next project is. Kind of the loose plan.
Yeah, that's a loose plan. And we haven't really done that yet. We haven't gone out with an act that's, you know, playing 500 to 3,000 cap rooms. We're still playing the club circuit, you know. I think the highest cap room we've played was a concert series at an opera house in Aspen, but it wasn't because that was on our tour circuit. We just got asked to play that.
Right.
Everything else has been 200 to 400 cap rooms. So to just get in front of people and to maybe win, you know, 5% to 10% of the people over.
Yeah.
That could be a lot of people on the right tour. So that sounds exciting to me. Also, it sounds exciting to me to just play for 45 minutes and rip through a set and then go relax starting at like 8:30. We had a couple shows on this last run where our set time was midnight. And you know, like some pretty grungy stuff happened on tour. And so, yeah, I'm excited about the prospect of an opening slot to see how that can boost our patronage.
Yeah.
And just a new experience.
Yeah.
I noticed that after that crazy year off, like after 2020, like coming back, a lot of clubs don't even have a midnight start anymore. Like the latest will be like 11. And like, there's one club here that, do you guys know the Continental Club here?
No, I don't think so.
A really good friend of mine he was really excited. Like some people came out of this pandemic, like I don't have to tour as much as I have this whole time. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm going to work smarter, not harder. And then some people are like, I miss playing so much. I'm going to start like three more bands and play every night of the week and all this shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I do know what you mean.
So this
yeah.
friend of mine got this weekly gig that was like midnight at the Continental Club. And I was like, I mean, we're both like, we're 53. Like at one point our audience would go, but I was like, dude, this is going to be the worst thing. Dude, there was like three people at every show. And then finally, dude, he moved it to like 9 the next month and it was packed again. But like, it seems like that midnight thing is kind of a post quarantine era. It's kind of gone by the wayside most places.
Right. I wonder if we all got used to being able to get more rest too over the last year. I certainly feel that way. I'm a little less inclined to go out and thrash late into the night because I realized how nice it is to go to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think where those sets were. New York City, definitely. We had an hour early show in New York City and that was at midnight at Mercury Lounge. We were the late show.
Yeah. Second show at Mercury.
That was tough.
That's a fun room to play, though.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
It was rad, and we had a great crowd. It was really, really fun and exciting once we got into it. But yeah, long night for sure.
Long night.
I think we got to our hotels at like 3:30, mm-hmm. maybe, and then had to get up fairly early the next day to go to Boston. It was, ooh.
Yeah. Tour, man. How long were you guys out? 2 months or a little over 2 months?
Right around 2 months.
We had, it was about two, yeah.
We had a little space off in between. We came home for about 8 days, but the last chunk, we were out for about 32 days, I think, in a row, which, you know, to a lot of people, that doesn't sound, when I say people, I mean, a lot of acts do more intensive touring than that. But for us and our preferences, that was, you know, we all have homes and pets and families, and it's just, for our preferences, that's a long time to be out.
Yeah.
So we're glad to be home, sort of settling in. We have a show in Nashville tomorrow. It's our last show of the year.
I saw that.
And the last one that's really planned right now. And so that's exciting. That's sort of like the period at the end of the sentence for this year for Bird Talker. I feel like I'll actually be able to take some real inventory and relax after about 11 p.m. tomorrow night. Which I'm looking forward to. Also looking forward to the show, obviously, friends, family, a fun venue. The venue that we're playing is in a complex of two other venues called the Cannery Row.
Oh.
And they're closing down. So that was a place that we cut our teeth, was at the High Watt and at Mercy Lounge. And we never played Cannery, but that'll be the last show we ever play there, which is also kind of special.
I think I know the place you're talking about. I think I've played
there. You probably do. I bet you have. Yeah, it's definitely a staple on the live music scene in Nashville. It's many, many, many shows all the time. And
I feel like the rest of the time I've only played at that 12th and Porter place.
12th and Porter? Is it there still?
I don't know.
I think it might be gone, 12th and Porter. But yeah, that was a cool venue too. I liked that venue a lot. That room was great.
Man, you know, I bet tomorrow night's going to be a great show. There's always that feeling. I tried to write on a tour, like really try and write a record, because I felt like what would happen when you'd come home from tour is you'd stop playing for a while. But really what you need to do is that's when a band should be recording. If a band is like a band, you know what I mean? Like, cause you're so fucking good after, you know, at the end of a tour, you're just so good. Like everyone's firing on all cylinders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, I feel that after this tour, I think more than ever before, because we were able to kind of like keep our energy moving on this tour. I think because we were better at it. And so the whole thing was smoother. And so, yeah, I really have this sense now that we're home of like, we really took in a lot of energy and inspiration during those 2 months. We played the shit out of this music. So I feel like we're definitely at home now with a sense of like momentum having been built. And it really does feel like we should, you know, do what we can to like keep that alive and keep writing it and kind of let it flow into the next thing.
Yeah. I imagine once this show is over tomorrow, we'll all be happy to enjoy the, you know, the next couple weeks of holiday time, whatever that means for us individually. And then, yeah, come January, at some point, I'm sure we'll start getting into a room together and seeing what happens with those chops that we've built up over the last several months. Because it does feel good to play music with people who are in the pocket. Yeah. And we've been in the pocket, which has been really, really lovely. So, I'm super curious what's going to happen and even what it's going to sound like. Because, like I said, this last project was a lot of my sensibilities. And we haven't really gotten into a room where everybody's collective historical influence is present to create an arrangement. So that's some new territory for us as a band to explore, which I'm excited about.
So those demos that you were recording were fully flushed out, sounded like a band, like there's guitar, bass,
yeah,
and drums.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like a band as much as Logic samples can sound like a band. But yeah, it was percussion parts, it was bass, it was piano, it was, you know, I built it out pretty good, background harmonies and such.
I have a question for you guys. I'm thinking about this now. Like, what were you going to do before music? Like, what was your life trajectory? You got married, you weren't professional musicians or aspiring to be that. What was your aspiration at that time?
I didn't have one, which is why this all just sort of happened the way it did. But God, we were like, Zach and I started a videography company for a minute. So we were like filming weddings in Nashville and
some corporate gigs too.
Some corporate stuff. And that was kind of a fun creative job. And it was fun to like build our own business and kind of learn what that felt like to be self-employed. And
it was also,
that was exciting.
It was also nice to pretend like we were not videographers, but we chose to, and we got to pretend to be something to the point where we started believing it ourselves, which I think carried over into Bird Talker too, because we definitely had some imposter syndrome early on, especially with the success of Heavy and some of those other songs. It was like very hard to relate to. So, early on, for me to answer your question, I graduated with a degree in graphic design. And I loved fine arts and I loved music, and I just did not know how or what direction specifically to move in. I didn't want to sit at a desk and create layouts and typeface arrangements. That didn't sound very inspiring because I'd done it before. So I didn't really know. I didn't know where I was going to go. And so what happened was exactly right, I suppose, up until this point.
Yeah.
We just sort of reacted for a while. We feel more proactive now, but we definitely reacted to circumstance and input from other people and just kept following this. But no real, as sad and strange as it sounds, no real ambition early on. I knew we felt magnetized to each other, and that was about all I knew when I was in my early 20s.
That's awesome.
But we figured it out. Lived in a house with roommates and a government subsidized apartment, and we figured it out.
were your families like worried?
They didn't present that way.
Probably.
Yeah. You had a little more empathy on your side probably because.
Yeah. Like my dad moved our family down to Nashville to write songs, right before I was born. So I grew up like watching my dad make that dream come alive for himself. And, it's funny. It was like a running joke in the house, you know, cause he had to work, I think like 13 years before he had like any real success with any songs that he had written. And he was, when I was a really young kid, he was like writing songs during the day and delivering pizzas at night. And it was kind of this long, hard road for him. And so he would always joke growing up about how being a musician wasn't like a real job and I should probably do something else, you know? So,
was he, even though
it was a joke?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Even though it was a joke, I think it sunk in because I never really thought about a career in music. I didn't thought of it more as like a hobby and something I enjoyed rather than a career path. I think my family definitely recognized that period of, you know, trying to start some new career in the arts, and like it takes a long time to cultivate and kind of bring it out into the world and turn it into something that can like give back to you, you know, and actually help you thrive. So I think they were probably concerned in some ways, but they also understood it. And, I think they could see that there was something in it that really just kept pulling us forward. And so, yeah, we all just kept the faith, and here's something happened.
Yeah. My family is a very conservative, like both financially, spiritually. And I was very surprised pleasantly with how they engaged my ambiguity and my vocation. They just basically, they said, as long as you're paying for the things that you need to pay for and you're not going into strenuous debt,
right?
Like we support you.
Yeah.
And, that felt very, empowering, I guess is a word. I didn't sense fear or stress from them about me.
Right.
I think they thought I was responsible, which made me feel responsible even more than I already thought I was. So I wanted to be a good steward of that belief. And, so I feel really glad to say that out loud. I actually haven't thought much about that. That's nice. Thanks for that question. Just the idea of feeling supported by family in the uncertainty of this line of work. That's nice to reflect on.
Yeah. I know there've been times, there were times when I knew when I left a room that people were like, oh my God, what's he, that poor guy, what's going to happen to him? You know what I mean? I have like half of my family is like this family of doctors. And so it took them a long time to realize that I had the same dedication to what I do that they do to what they do. And then everything became cool. But there was a weird time. My grandfather, he lived in Houston and was a doctor, and he had a friend that worked at Enron. Do you guys remember what happened to Enron?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So in the early 90s, he was always like, you know, I got that friend, you know, at Enron. Can get you in there. You start off making really good money.
Yeah.
Anyway. So as far as like the song Heavy, because I'm kind of fascinated with this, like how did it get so many eyes on it? Like I mean, it's a great song and it deserves eyes on it, but there are many great songs out there that just can't cross over that 5,000 mark, you know?
Yeah.
I would say a large piece of that puzzle was relationships forged before we released it. Our manager had relationships with playlist curators at Spotify, and he pitched the music. Obviously we didn't pay them anything, but they liked it enough to put it on a couple pretty key playlists with a lot of listeners. And once that happened, the organic growth of it was also very real. Like the reason it got put on more playlists was because it was saved and shared so many times. It kept perpetuating the plays because it kept getting saved,
because it was
shared and added.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. It's a good song. It's a really good song.
I also think there was more hype around playlisting at the time.
Yeah. In 2016.
I think there were, playlists were still kind of like new and exciting, and there weren't as many of them.
Yeah.
So I think there were a lot of people listening.
Right.
You know, whereas now like tons of playlists and it's less of a thing, but yeah, I think it was just the right moment where we got enough ears on it and people engaged with it enough that, I mean, honestly, the numbers still don't make sense to me. I have no way of understanding it or explaining it besides that. But yeah.
Did that translate to a lot of audiences, like good, solid audiences around the country?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
It just depended on where we were geographically. I mean, people showed up everywhere we went.
Right.
Which means something.
Yeah.
You know, we also, I think the first large show we played outside of Nashville was Denver. And we had, you know, about 100 people show up our first show there. And we were sort of blown away.
Yeah, that's a lot of people for your first show in a market that you've never played.
It was a lot of people. But then on the same tour, a few days later, we were in Boise and we had 2 people buy tickets. And the only shirt we sold was from somebody who said their son liked birds. So, you know, a lot of opposite ends of the spectrum of our experience. It had nothing to do with the band. It was just that there was a picture of a bird on it. Well, they just said the word bird. Yeah, that's funny.
Did you guys do any kind of like radio campaign for it or anything?
We kind of did. We hired a guy named Paul Brown, who's a lovely man and is working with us now, to work AAA and non-com. And I think the reason it fell flat was because we had no story underneath it. Like none of the smaller local radio stations had seen it or heard it and supported it. We didn't run like a ground level foundational radio campaign. We just went right to a higher level of radio.
Right.
And I think that it just didn't work because there was no story,
right?
Except for, you know, the number of streams we had. Nobody knew who Bird Talker was.
Yeah, a fucking playlist, like
or a playlist on Spotify that can come and go. There was no real story, so yeah, we just started a radio campaign about 8 weeks ago for, I think, Old Sob Story is the main song we're highlighting, and then Taking Control actually I think has been played a few times. We've gotten probably like 30, 40 ads across the country, which is amazing. And it's just it's the slow and steady build. But to circle back, we sort of had a radio campaign for Heavy, but we didn't really build underneath it enough for it to really make an impact or support us.
Do you notice that the radio, when the radio is strong in a certain town, that like, do you find radio to be stronger than a playlist still?
I don't know if we have an answer for that yet, because I feel our radio campaign was sort of just getting started around the same time that we went on tour this year.
Right.
So it didn't really play into ticket sales a whole lot, except I do remember one night that like there were two guys in the crowd that had heard us on the radio that day and decided to go buy tickets and come to the show. And so there was a little bit of connection with that.
Hey, it works.
It works. It still works, man.
Like, there it is. It worked.
Thanks, two new friends.
Which is weird because since everything shifted so much, like you know what I mean? Like you don't.
Totally.
Yeah. I don't know what to expect from the radio play. And
right.
Maybe we won't know until next year, just because of like what we're saying. We just kind of started it now. So it's something that we'll probably build and grow into.
Well, yeah, and that question lingers in the industry from my experience.
Yeah.
Talking with other managers and talking with other labels and talking with business management, like how relevant is radio still? And that's not like a posturing question. It's just,
exactly,
because the listening to music has changed so much. How impactful is doing a proper radio campaign,
right,
or touring into going to the studios and like giving them a record and making relationships? I know it's relevant for other genres of music, you know, definitely still for country radio.
Right.
I've observed that. But for independent, like alternative artists, we don't really have any metrics yet for that. For our narrative.
Right.
And I know that question is still being held loosely by everybody around me.
You know what I've noticed over like the last like 10 years, it used to be like you could go on the, I would hardly ever even go on the college stations here in town because we had access to like the major rock stations or whatever. And like at one point that was a fucking like sellout thing. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like it would be huge for your show. And now I notice that the non-commercial, like here we have KUTX and another radio station called Sun Radio. And it seems like the people that listen to those stations react more. Like I notice if I go on the major rock station, even now that I was on in the 90s, there's not people coming to my show from that thing as much as there are from the non-com stations, because it seems like they're actual music fans listening to that, not just somebody listening to the radio on their way to somewhere. You know what I'm saying? Like there's a connection with music.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely radio stations that feel more that way than others.
Right.
I think there's a channel in Nashville called Lightning 100 that is specifically geared to independent artists, and they play some hot stuff too, but I think that they have a pretty dedicated listenership, not just for passive transportation to work listening. Like, but
people want to discover music and go to shows. And
exactly.
Be really engaged with what the station's doing. So, yeah. Well, like you're right.
The kind of people that the two guys that came to your show, like they're the kind of people that would hear something they like and then like buy tickets. Like, shit, that band's in town. Let's go see them, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like it's hard to find those fans at this point. It's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Translating. That's another question that's really interesting to me is how do acts, because there's a lot of acts, especially on Spotify, because the numbers are so observable, that have really wonderful streaming numbers, but they can't, you know, they can't even sell 300 tickets in their hometown.
Right. Yeah.
And then sometimes they can sell 1,000 tickets in Seattle. Like, how do you bridge the gap between those numbers and people showing up in a room? That's also a very relevant and unanswerable question currently that people are trying to generate innovative ways of doing that. And I have a lot of curiosity about it too, because we, you know, people do come. We probably averaged about 120 to 150 ticket sales this year, maybe a little less. I'm sure some of that was impacted by COVID, but we have a lot more streams than that.
That's
not a perfect parallel, but like I would, just looking at numbers, expect more people to show up. That's just curiosity we all have.
Yeah. And you know, it's weird, 'cause I I'm trying to find a way to say this where it doesn't make me look like a dick, but
no, go
like, be no, a dick. Not to you guys, just like to the world. But like, I'm 53. So like, I started doing this when I was like 14. And so like throughout there was a point where like, when I heard a song I liked, when I became engaged with music and like a consumer and a fucking fan, yeah. I had to remember who that was, go to the store, use money to buy a thing, and then I had the thing. Sure. And then I was like, oh shit, I got it. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I feel like the engagement with music is not as deep generally. There's still huge music fans and people like those two guys. There's people, you know, there's still those kind of people, but that used to be kind of like the way people were, you know?
Sure. Yeah. That feels very true. Even in, you know, my less years, that feels true. Like the special nature of that kind of relationship with music that you just articulated, hearing something on the radio and being like, shit, what is this? And, you know, writing it down or committing it to memory and going to a music shop, buying a CD and like falling in love with that record and then going to see the show because you had that special line of experience. That's a much more unique storyline now. That happens as the exception to the rule, I think. Now, where you're just, I mean, I'm guilty of it too. I listen passively to Spotify all the time. I listen to hundreds of songs all the time. And, you know, there's a moment in a song that otherwise, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago, I would have been like, oh my God, who is this? But then I'm inundated with so much sound that it's just more of like a little momentary sparkle. I'm like, oh, that was nice. It's not like, who is this? How do I see them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the overwhelmingly, just the overwhelm of sound that is available with clicks and pops with my fingers.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just the climate. Maybe there isn't really a way to bridge it. Maybe it starts with the individual all the time. And like you said, the people who listen, who want to come, like those two guys do that.
Yeah.
But there's sort of a softness around the intensity of music listenership right now that is new in human history.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe that's just okay in the way it is, and we have to be innovative and creative and finding ways to bridge that gap.
I'm still,
and that's happening right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm still a firm believer that getting out there in front of people over and over again and being really good and being something worth seeing and worth telling your friends to come see is
that's a way
is still a way to make it go.
True, I believe that too.
I think so too. I think this tour kind of reminded me of that too. Just how powerful it is to like share music in a room.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
All the music I consumed for the last 18 months was, you know, passively through Spotify or YouTube or whatever. And so there's real magic in being in the room and making music together. And I think there's reason to focus on that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, God, yeah. Who knows? Who knows how this goes?
Who knows how it goes? Well, you guys made a great record. I don't want to get off that. Your self-titled LP for those listening is available now wherever people stream and download their music. It's really great talking to you guys, Danny and Zach.
Yeah, cool. Johnny, thank you for your time, man.
You too, man. Yeah,
thank you for your time.
Cool. Of course.
Hopefully I'll see you next time. I wish I would have known that you guys were coming to Antone's. I think I saw on that date I wasn't playing, so I would have been able to go.
Hopefully we come back and play Antone's again.
Again.
That's what we would love. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys South by Southwest? No. Any?
Never once.
We never have. No.
But not this coming year. We'd like to.
No, we're a little behind even in booking any festival dates or showcase dates. I'm curious if we're going to land any, actually. But no, we're not playing South by Southwest this year.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you guys. And I wish you a lot of luck, and I hope to meet you in person someday. I really do love this record. It's really fucking great. You guys are a real great team.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're sweet, man. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you guys, too. Take care. I'll let you guys know when this drops.
Cool, man. Thank you so much.
Sounds see
you,
good. Nice see to meet you.
That's Zach and Danny Green from Nashville, born and bred alt-country five-piece bird talker. Their self-titled sophomore LP available now wherever it is you stream and download your jams. Find them at birdtalkermusic.com. Great conversation, man. What a great conversation. I love that song, Better Days. You'll hear the rest of it as soon as I stop talking. Hey, gang, when you're out there checking out birdtalkermusic.com, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, all the places, new shows every Tuesday, every Friday. Sometimes I drop even more. And look out for some From the Vault episodes coming pretty soon. That's right, old shows. It's because we've been doing this for over 10 years, man. I got tons of content. It's out there. And if you really want to get involved with that, you can go to join the Podbean app, or get the Podbean app, sorry. Get the Podbean app and you'll have access to all of your favorite shows and also every single episode of How Did I Get Here ever put out. All right, so check it out. Have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
Something new.